Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm always joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, in this episode, we're going to explore the federal criminal cases against music mogul Sean Diddy Combs and look closely at why he's currently being held in the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York City and not released on bond. His next court appearance currently is scheduled for October 9th, when it's expected that a trial date will be set for him. Now, some of you who may follow WOUB's podcast may have heard this already, but I think the vast majority of our audience has not, and that is on a WOUB podcast called Spectrum. That's S-P-E-C-T-R-U-M, Spectrum at WOUB, and it's on all your podcast outlets. Judge Gail and I did a program back on April 4th where we talked about, we sort of started down this road with Sean Diddy Combs. The title of that episode was "What Does Music Mogul Sean Diddy Combs and Donald Trump Have in Common?" And we talked about search warrants at that point, and the results of those search warrants that were executed on Diddy's homes, in part, brought about the criminal charges that he is now facing. So, Judge Gail, we've got a lot to talk about today.
Boy, do we. And even more parallels, right? Because both of those search warrants yielded federal indictments.
Both of them did. And let's sort of outline what we're talking about. Some people, I'm sure, know this verbatim. Other people don't know it much at all. Sean Combs is facing federal charges in the Southern District of New York and a legal indictment charging him with racketeering conspiracy, sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion, and transportation to engage in prostitution. So racketeering conspiracy carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. Sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion also has a maximum sentence of possible life in prison, but a mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years in prison. And transportation for the purposes of prostitution carries a maximum sentence of 10 years. All of these are felonies, and they occur from 2008 forward. The indictment alleges that Combs abused, threatened, and coerced women and others around him to fulfill sexual desires, protect reputation, and conceal conduct. Although the indictment focuses on those three things, also the feds are looking at other issues involving the music industry Combs heading what's called a criminal enterprise, saying that members of his group or associates engaged in everything from sex trafficking, forced labor, kidnapping, arson, bribery, obstruction of justice, etc. Now, one other clarification before we go forward, and that is Sean Combs is also facing a slew of civil suits, and we'll talk about that some, but we're mainly focused on the criminal charges today. As you know, criminal charges are crimes against the state or the government, in this case, the United States of America, and they carry penalties of possible incarceration, where civil cases are suits for damages. So with that, Judge Gail, where do you want to start?
I say we start with helping our audience kind of understand the definition or legal definition of some of the charges that the defendant, Mr. Combs, is facing. I want to say, as we do in breaking down all of these cases, and especially because we're both retired judges, we do not presume or suppose that anyone is already convicted of these charges. Of course,
not at all.
Mr. Combs enjoys being cloaked in innocence until he's proven guilty, either by a judge or a jury of his peers. And so we approach this case like we do every other case we break down for you, with the same integrity and commitment to that legal standard. But we do think it's important for you to understand, because what no doubt will happen, and I hope you can agree with me, Judge, is that folks will start, you know, throwing around these terms like racketeering, criminal enterprises, human trafficking, without perhaps knowing what they mean when you walk into a courtroom and how those legal definitions are applied. And right. Also, what judges are taking into consideration when they're making certain decisions in cases, even in the early stages like this one, for purposes of bond, which I think we've already outlined in previous podcast episodes. But I'd like to remind our audience what the purpose of bond is. Judge, do you want to start by just reminding us what purpose bond serves and generally the things the judge takes into consideration?
Yeah, let's do that. But let's back up just a tad, if we could. Again, these charges that we're talking about came from indictments, which were rendered by a grand jury. The prosecution, the U.S. District Attorney, took matters to a grand jury, who then issued these indictments. At some point, and I think it was September 16th, if I'm not mistaken, in New York, as a result of these indictments being issued, Sean Combs was arrested, taken into custody by the federal authority. He then comes to court for a first time, which is, if in a federal system, is called an arraignment. An arraignment is a time where he and his attorneys enter a plea on his behalf. Well, obviously, in this case, he entered a plea of not guilty to all of the charges, and that's where we stand as of today. That brings us to the question that Judge Gale was asking me, and that is, the judge then at that arraignment makes a decision whether or not the person should be kept incarcerated or let loose on bond or bail. So those terms are used interchangeably. And if so, under what conditions can the person be let go? Now, in the federal system, that initial decision is made by a magistrate. A magistrate is someone appointed to hear the preliminary parts of criminal cases and other forms of litigation in the federal system. The magistrate hears from the prosecution and from the defense as to whether or not this person is a risk to flee, and that means go beyond the jurisdiction where the court can no longer get a hold of the person. In this case, it would probably be out of the country someplace, and certainly Mr. Combs has the financial wherewithal to do that. So that's one concern. A second concern is, if a person is released, would they be likely to intimidate witnesses or somehow try to interfere with the system? Well, that was one of the prosecution's arguments here, that yes, Mr. Combs would likely, because of his alleged past conduct, intimidate witnesses. And the third is, you know, the seriousness of the crimes. And in this case, because there are so many, some 50 people have come forward to bring about these indictments, that was a consideration. In other cases, it's, and in this case as well, is the defendant have a propensity for violence? And in this case, there were allegations of numerous firearms being collected during searches, charges of basically careless use of firearms or intimidating people with firearms were alleged by the prosecution. So that was another consideration. So all told, with all of this, the magistrate said, no bond, you're going to stay in jail. That sort of set off the defense attorneys and went, no, we can't do this. So they came up with a proposal of an alternative that they then ran by the judge in the case, not the magistrate. And Judge Gale and I can get into the details of that. But the judge said, no, he's going to stay in jail. Now, just this week, the attorneys for Mr. Combs have taken this matter to the Second District Court of Appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the circuit that involves New York City. And they're trying to get the Court of Appeals to release Mr. Combs under certain conditions and allow him to go free. That's a long-winded answer, Judge Gale, but I hope that gets into what you wanted me to talk about.
Indeed. Very astute and professorial. But and exactly par for the course for such a learned judge. And so, hopefully what folks appreciate is what you've, those considerations that you've outlined, the court sometimes refers to as factors, factors they should, that the court will consider in order to decide or determine bond. And one thing I would note, just to kind of dovetail on something you mentioned, was the fact that in this instance, the prosecutors anticipated that there would be a request for a bond. They anticipated that the attorneys for Mr. Combs would make a very forceful argument and perhaps even some concessions that would seem amazingly generous and sacrificial in order to help ensure his release while this matter is pending. And I would venture even to say, at least it obviously appears that way, given their appeal to the Second District, that the package or the offer that was presented by Mr. Combs' defense attorneys, the rejection of that offer by the court was shocking. Given that the prosecutors had always planned to argue to the court that they believed essentially that, you know, no set of concessions, no set of sacrifices, no set of terms would be sufficient to basically satisfy what you said is the purpose of bond, which is, in essence, folks, it is the terms and or conditions upon which someone who's facing criminal charges may be permitted to share the general community with everyone else while their case is still pending. And the court has to decide, as the judge eloquently outlined, has to decide in using all of those considerations, all of those factors, which ones are satisfied to the court's degree of calmness, or the court is completely satisfied with it, or to what degree is the court unnerved by the ability of the defendant to comply? I quite frankly think one of the things that, although was so important, it actually became a bit of a focal point, which isn't, you know, often for a lot of criminal defendants, was the access to vast financial resources. And access to vast financial resources or basically a lot of money, Judge, could mean a lot of things in a criminal case. It could mean the ability to employ people to do your bidding, even if you don't do it yourself. It also could help to allow the defendant to abscond or to leave the jurisdiction or the immediate area, never to return to court again, and to never perhaps face the charges and the full breadth of the legal system. Those resources could allow for the disappearance or the swaying of the cooperation of witnesses or other individuals who are cooperating. And another thing that I think the prosecutors are very clear to outline is that their investigation is ongoing.
Ongoing. Right.
And so what the court sees now may not be what is ultimately presented. And for you and I, given our experience, for me especially, I think it immediately set off the bells to me to say there's probably going to be what we call a superseding indictment because the investigation is ongoing, because
we had in the Trump case.
Exactly.
In the federal case in Washington.
More parallels, right?
Yeah.
So it continues to be parallel in that I believe because the investigation is ongoing, because there are more individuals that continue to come forward, because now, especially because the defendant is remanded, meaning he's in an incarcerated environment. He's in jail. He's in prison while his matter's pending, which gives him less access to witnesses or other individuals and probably anyone other than perhaps his immediate family and his attorneys. Then that means witnesses may feel more comfortable coming forward and cooperating. There may be potential co-defendants who may feel more comfortable cooperating. And that could possibly result in taking this matter back to a grand jury and asking that grand jury to return additional or more charges than what the defendant is currently facing. That would mean those new charges or those additional charges would supersede or be in addition to or greater than what was originally placed against Mr. Combs in the original indictment. So the four charges that we see may not be the only charges that he ultimately faces. What are your thoughts about that, Judge?
Well, I agree with you 100%. I think that they have an ongoing investigation. They're still talking to people. The fact that he is in jail will expedite the trial date. And I need to explain that to people. If somebody's incarcerated, they come to trial first. They go to the head of the line as far as trials go. But at the same time, the prosecution wants some time so that they can further the investigation and see if there are more charges to bring. So it's going to be an interesting balance to see what comes up on October 9th. One thing I think that we need to make very clear, though, Judge, and I know you feel this way, I feel this way, it is the premise of bond or bail not to be a pre-trial punishment. It is not to be
absolutely
a pre-trial predetermination that this person is guilty and therefore they must be incarcerated. Instead, it is to ensure the safety of the public, the safety of the individual who is being charged, and their likelihood to continue to appear at each and every stage of the proceeding. Some people think that bond ought to be a punishment. Judges cannot look at it that way, and it's not intended to be that.
You're absolutely correct. Bond is and never should be used as a tool to punish or pre-punish defendants who appear before the court. As you just said, and as I said before, the purpose is to make sure that the victim who represents the greater society in that instance. So some people say, my gosh, Judge Judge Hodson just said that it's the state versus Mr. Combs, but there are all of these victims. And that is absolutely true. But when we're talking about criminal cases, we consider crimes to be offenses against all of society, where the victims stand in as the representative of society in that instance. And so it's not as if the victims are discounted. In fact, their concerns are taken into consideration for purposes of bond. Will victims be safe? Will their families be safe? Will the defendant themselves be safe? Judge, I don't know if you've ever had an instance when you've made a determination that you believe the defendant may actually be safer remanded or in jail than in the community, because there may very well be a greater risk to them in the community than being remanded into jail. Has that ever been an experience you've had? I know as a prosecutor, I've certainly had to entertain arguments of that nature.
I have, and it, sometimes the person is far better off being in jail because a upset relative or business associate or alleged victim, you know, could want to take the law into their own hands and
vigilante justice
and go after the person. That's right, vigilante justice. Let me move to one other thing here, Judge, and get your reaction specifically. During this whole process to this point, Sean Combs' lawyers made this offer to the court, which has been rejected: $50 million bail bond posted to the court, which means that if he violated that bond, that money would be forfeited to the government. So $50 million bail package.
Can I pause you there and just say, I would not have 50 cents. So $50 million was just thunderstriking. So yeah.
$50 million bail package in exchange for him being placed under house arrest at his Florida mansion with GPS monitoring. That's typical of many people that are released on bond. Strict limits on visitors and 24/7 surveillance. Now, that was the offer. It was countered by the prosecutor, Emily Johnson, who told the judge that Combs had a long history of intimidating both accusers and witnesses to his alleged abuse. She cited text messages from women who said Combs forced them into the freak-offs, the sex parties that are the foundation of this.
And modern-day orgies, that's
there
just
you
what
go.
They are.
And then threatened to leak explicit videos of them engaging in sex acts. She also said that Combs' own defense team was minimizing the horrifically understating his propensity for violence. Now, you've got this big offer, $50 million, 24/7 surveillance. You've got the prosecutor saying, hey, this is a violent dude. He threatens people. He intimidates people. He basically blackmails people, although that's not one of the charges, but that's he certainly sounds like that's part of it.
You know, well, remember, that's also an element of human trafficking, the force,
yes,
fraud, or coercion.
Right. So if you're given all that, what do you think? And let me add one more thing. We have not entirely dissimilar situation here with Jeffrey Epstein, who was arrested for very similar charges, if not exactly the same charges, was held in a detention facility and ended up allegedly committing suicide while he was in there, although some people question the actual method of his death. So you've got a precedent ahead of you saying you don't let people charged with these kinds of things out, especially people with a lot of money. What do you do with this?
Well, Judge, I'll actually draw another parallel where perhaps the argument is, well, maybe we do. Because if you look at the former president who has faced, you know, similar accusations, and although the sex assault charges sex assault charges, but certainly has faced extremely serious criminal charges up to and including, you know, holding on to and failing to return top secret government documents that could endanger all Americans potentially, and the power to, I mean, where you have, you know, allegedly Mr. Combs, who is the head of a criminal enterprise or syndicate and maybe has minions that could be dispatched to do his bidding at a moment's notice. You have another individual who has perhaps the loudest megaphone that we give any person and on the largest, loudest stage, who could bring together an entire army of angry individuals who, at least at one point, there's certainly the argument that's been made that at least on one day in American history, gathered enough angry individuals who were prepared to perhaps even kill the vice president. And these are both billionaires. One of them has never seen the inside of a jail, while the other is sitting inside of one. And so I certainly understand that parallel. And it would seem that when aligned with Mr. Epstein, that yes, those seem very similar, but when compared to the former president, it seems very dissimilar. And the gravity and the potential impact to society is equal, perhaps maybe even greater, if you consider the potential to harm, you know, a larger swath of society by the behavior of the alleged behavior of the former vice president. But that said, were I the judge listening to such a package of concessions made by a defense team on behalf of their client, you first have to understand that not every defendant is similarly situated. And so $50 million to someone who is a billionaire on balance is maybe just a little bit shy of lunch money.
A little more than pocket change and a little shy of lunch money.
A little bit shy of lunch money, but $50 million to someone, you know, who would necessarily need just about every human being they know and have even a halfway decent relationship with in their entire life to pool resources together to actually raise the money for that kind of a bond is very different. Those folks are not situated similarly. That second individual likely does not have an entire staff that works for them. They likely do not also wield an enormous amount of power and influence. They likely do not have access to private jets or transportation that could take them outside of the court's jurisdiction, which would be what we call outside the reach of the court. And it could certainly then cause harm to others. I would also go another step here and encourage you to consider this, which, again, being the recovering prosecutor that I am, is something I think that's worthy of pointing out. And I believe the prosecutor in this matter was very careful to ensure that the court was aware, especially as it related to the issue of the ongoing investigation. Because what was alleged was that while the defendant, Mr. Combs, was aware that this investigation was ongoing and was aware that certain individuals had been subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury as witnesses, he nonetheless insisted on contacting those witnesses, seeking to sway, change, or obstruct their testimony to the degree that these conversations, at least on two occasions, were recorded. I think the prosecutor went as far as to say one witness in particular had been contacted via text message or other means, Judge, more than 50 times. While the defendant was aware that the witness was under a grand jury subpoena, was cooperating with the prosecution, and the effort was all designed to get this particular witness to change their testimony. Now, that actually may go to the issue of culpability and whether or not the defendant knew essentially that the jig was up. And if you even took into consideration the generosity of the package that the defense counsel put forward to the court, I think as a judge, I would consider those additional pieces of evidence or that additional information at that point. Again, because you're not considering it for the purpose of deciding whether he's actually guilty of the crimes alleged, you're strictly focused on whether or not this individual should be released back into the public. Do you want to run into him at the local, you know, KFC or the local Walgreens picking up your prescription for your eye drops? Or, you know, are you looking to stand next to him while you're pumping your gas at the gas station? Does the community feel safe while this matter is pending, knowing now all that we know and knowing the strength of the evidence, knowing what we know? As a judge, I would absolutely have to take those things into consideration and would absolutely invite the defense to quell those concerns, because those would be red flags and probably, you know, firecrackers and sticks of dynamite just going off in my head. Like, this is, you know, any package put together would probably be the worst idea in the history of bad ideas. And I'm not certain how you would interpret that. Obviously, certainly you do have to consider this on balance again and giving the defendant the benefit of being cloaked in innocence. But with the prosecution making such a compelling argument, and I'll even go as far as to say the prosecution, when anticipating this argument, even provided the court with some evidence that they no doubt will use at trial, including but not limited to video evidence, other recordings. And so they were extremely comfortable in the forcefulness of the evidence that they had, notwithstanding the fact that the defendant, Mr. Combs, traveled from Florida to New York and was living in New York in the weeks preceding his arrest to essentially demonstrate good faith in this process and to be sure to surrender when the indictment was handed down, but was ultimately arrested. And I don't know if that has any connectivity to him reaching out allegedly to that witness that the prosecution insisted he had attempted to reach more than 50 times, but they certainly arrested him before he could surrender, which also says something about what the state believes his either propensity for violence is or his propensity for flight might be, or the lack of safety to the community.
Also, if someone appears voluntarily, that's a consideration that judges have to consider for bond.
Oh, yes.
If somebody voluntarily shows up and you don't have to go out and arrest them or chase them or whatever, you know, that is basically an offer of good faith, saying, look, we're cooperating, and his attorneys have said this all along, we're cooperating at every step of this investigation, and we were prepared to surrender ourselves, but no, they had to come and arrest him. From a defense point of view, that certainly can be an argument. Let me ask you this. You know, in criminal cases like this, another consideration for bond is, does the person not only have a propensity for violence, and we've talked about that, but does the person have a past criminal record? In this case, there's no allegation of a past criminal record, but we have these civil cases. There was one filed by his ex-girlfriend that was settled immediately, a civil allegation of including rape, sexual assault, and forced drugging. Sounds familiar to the current charges. We have a Houston attorney just on October 1st saying that he represents 120 accusers that'll be filing individual lawsuits, not a class action.
Not a class action.
But individual lawsuits against Mr. Combs. And that 120, which, by the way, 60 males and 60 females, came out of 3,280 people who had contacted the law firm about Mr. Combs with their stories. They ran down, substantiated, and they came up with 120. So we have past instances of civil charges of a similar nature. We have an attorney announcing that he's going to be filing all of these suits.
One attorney. That doesn't include the other civil lawsuits pending.
The other ones that are already pending.
Correct.
So can a judge use civil cases such as that, which have a total different standard of proof, and we've talked about that a bit, they're not as serious because they can't take away somebody's liberty. They can just take away somebody's money. They're still serious, but they don't take away somebody's liberty for life. Can a judge use those to be comparable with a person's past criminal record?
Well, so I think the short answer is that it all depends, and it definitely depends on the nature of what those civil matters are. There's clear connectivity, at least in this instance, between the perhaps the bombshell civil case, the first one that was filed against Mr. Combs that was settled within 24 hours of it being filed. I'm not even sure if the ink was dry on the clerk's stamp in the courthouse before the matter was settled. So that was settled really quickly. However, understanding that even with the swift settlement of that civil case, from that was born largely the criminal investigation. And that is definitely so important. It's so important because if you look at this particular indictment, one of the pieces of evidence that was attached for the court to consider when determining the issue of bond was video evidence that actually buttressed that civil case. And that was video evidence of the plaintiff in that civil case who's identified as a victim in the criminal matters. But the plaintiff in that civil case was viciously, violently beaten in a hotel lobby where there were cameras in the lobby. Those videos were suppressed for about 7 years. And allegedly, at the behest of the defendant who had bribed either employees or agents of that hotel to either erase or to make unavailable that video, which ultimately did become available. And again, shortly after that civil lawsuit was filed, it was settled. But then that's also when the criminal matter kind of caught legs and gave rise, and it actually buttressed that. But one thing I'm going to roll this back to, and it began with something you said initially, which is the fact that you are correct. Taking into consideration a defendant's prior criminal record is something that is important. At least on its face, it appears the defendant has no prior criminal convictions. And that is where criminal record is born out of, is out of convictions. Mere allegations does not make one convicted, because as we said at the top of this episode, is the fact that Mr. Combs, just like every other defendant, is cloaked in innocence and will be considered such until proven guilty. However, there have been instances throughout his life and career where he himself has been implicated as being part of criminal activity, also outlined as part in even in the prosecution's detention letter, that he's been implicated in this criminal activity and has been able to escape culpability or escape being made responsible because of his status, because of his connection to the industry, because of his connection to other individuals in powerful positions. So this is kind of that quintessential example of how powerful people have escaped responsibility for some of perhaps the more, you know, heinous and, you know, morally depraved behavior that they've been involved in. I mean, some of the behavior even included, you know, shooting an individual or allegedly shooting an individual at a nightclub, which someone else in the entourage and the defendant's entourage took the fall for and actually went to prison for, actually being part of a scheme and a plan to set fire to another individual's vehicle. And actually joking about it, and that's the arson argument, is it, that he actually colluded to set fire to someone's vehicle and was very brazenly open about it, allegedly. So these things, the prosecution was very clear to make the court aware of, and I think also to make sure that the court knew that they weren't alleging that the defendant had been previously convicted and that he wasn't convicted, but that in light of these, what they believe to be very well substantiated and documented incidences, not just mere claims, but actual activity, which tracks allegedly with his you know, with his volatile responses and attitudes, and in addition to all of these other civil lawsuits, that gave more forcefulness to the fact that these civil claims actually in many instances may have a criminal counterpart, even if it's not before the court right now, but the court should certainly take them seriously because of the impact and the harm and also the connectivity to it. It would not surprise me at all if some of these witnesses in these civil matters are also witnesses in the criminal matter and vice versa. It just seems like there's a whole lot of I won't even say gray area. There's a whole lot of, you know, cross connection between both the civil and the criminal matter, such that I think by the time it's done, we won't be referring to him as P. Diddy. He's going to be more like P. Penny, because that's about all he's going to have left.
Well, the underlying basis of all of this, we talked to the judge, Judge Gale called it orgies, are what are called freak-offs.
Yes, and the baby oil industry is going to be bankrupt when this is all over.
And they occurred 16 times in bringing about the indictment. And these were lavishly produced sexual performances. That's how they've been described. Cameras hidden everywhere. Taking cameras of people, these things would go on for days. They take videos of people. They allegedly use physical, emotional, and verbal abuse to get people engaged,
as well as drug use to encourage continued compliance. I mean, it's so much
drugs and drinks and yes, that kind of thing.
But so much so that at its conclusion, it would require IV. Treatment in order to rehydrate or to restore not just the participant victims, but the defendant himself. This it is something that, and again, let's be really clear. Let's be clear, listeners. I do not know personally, nor have I ever attended, and I have no firsthand knowledge of what a freak-off is. Right. However, by its description, one could only surmise that these had to be, you know, something that, you know, essentially an Academy Award worthy orgy, because it seems like it required so much involvement. And if you read, again, some of the documents filed by the prosecution, and Judge, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, there at least is one instance where the prosecution notes that there was so much damage that was done to a particular penthouse at a hotel, such that the defendant was billed and paid $40 plus $50,000 to the hotel for damage and repair to the penthouse following one of these events. Now, that's $40,000 is a hefty down payment. I think I don't even know if you got, you know, you don't even have presidential candidates promising that for first-time homeowners. My goodness.
That's a raucous sexual event.
Right? Respect for furniture.
I have to say, that is a raucous event.
$40,000 in damage to the property. And that to me is just, that's amazing. Which, by the way, in many jurisdictions would be considered criminal damaging. That would be a crime all its own, even without cutting the check. $40,000 would be restitution, but the crime itself would be the damage you caused to the property as a result of that, because no one rents or, permits a reservation to their hotel, and especially not a penthouse, with the anticipation that they won't be able to use it or rent it or provide its use to anyone else until they've now cured $40,000+ in damage. Anyone else might very well have been facing criminal charges for that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What does the Court of Appeals do with this? You know, the Second Circuit now has it. Bond is usually, unless you have a heinous, sort of serial killer, is preferred in the law, not required, but preferred in the law, with limiting restrictions on mobility, contact, et cetera, the things that we've talked about. So what does Court of Appeals do with this?
Well, Judge, let's just be clear. It's 2024. So I'm going to venture to say, first and foremost, the appellate panel, whether it's a panel or if it's en banc, meaning all the judges come here, which I can't imagine why it would be en banc, because I'd probably want to kick this can down the road to one of my colleagues were, right, were I there. But I think the first thing they're going to do is they're going to make, you know, Merriam-Webster's word of the year freak offs, because they're all going to be first trying to look up and define exactly what it is that they're talking about and why is this thing so bad. And how do we balance this in this realm of legalese and under these factors that we consider? But I think the other thing is they're going to be listening to the defense. And if I were the defense attorney, and I know I am not a recovering defense attorney, and I'm going to ask you to jump in here.
I am.
But if I were the defense, I mean, there are only a few ways that you can massage this so that it becomes palatable to judges who are probably, I will say, not very well exposed to this kind of behavior with any level of regularity. And I suspect that they will begin with an argument that the defendant is, he is a, maybe a very normal, highly, sexualized and active young man for a 50-year-old, that he may engage in 54. Activity. Yeah, he may engage in activity that may not be traditional, but non-traditional sexual activity is not criminal sexual activity when there are consenting adults. And so that's why I think they'll argue that's why he's pled not guilty, because he's going to insist that these activities were consensual, and that there were quid pro quos. So in exchange for it, he offered and agreed to provide other benefits to participants, and that might have included money or trips or,
or
houses or vehicles.
Professional status.
Or access. And that they are, if I were a good defense attorney, I think the argument would be, hey, this was kind of the agreement. This wasn't a force. This wasn't coercion. They wanted what I had, which was access. And in exchange for us consenting to do this, this is what I gave. This is what they gave. And I think that they'll also argue and say, hey, listen, and when it came to, everything else, they had pre-existing drug problems. They had issues. And what he didn't want is for them to discolor this to the prosecutors and anyone else. And so certainly he has a reputation to protect and he has a fortune to protect, and that he deserves to, like as you said, he deserves that the benefit that any other similarly situated defendant would enjoy, and that the conditions of bond can be met, and that over and above the factors that have been outlined for the court to consider, he has not only met those factors, but that he's worked to exceed them by suggesting this bond package that most would never be able to even offer, much less comply with. And he's just that committed to seeing this through that he's offered over and above to demonstrate how committed he is to this. Now, okay, whether or not that falls on deaf ears is a different story, because certainly the prosecution has a totally different perception of Mr. Combs.
I'm going to say something controversial here. So are you ready?
If it can be more controversial than how I've just described what Merriam-Webster is going to be, have at it.
If I'm the defense, part of my defense, I believe, just knowing the little bit that I know from all the reading that we've done on this.
Oh, you're going to learn a lot over the next few months.
Yeah. I'm gonna start making my racial argument at this bond argument. That but for him being black and being a black professional man, he would not be in jail.
Wow.
And that this activity of the freak-offs, et cetera, is commonplace and among white population, it doesn't even get charged, let alone have the defendant be incarcerated. I'm going to play that at trial. So I'm going to start planting that seed at the bond hearing.
You're going to lay the groundwork early and say, wait a minute, you know, all of my other non-minority counterparts do this nothing happens to them.
What do you think of that? I mean, that's controversial, but if I have nothing else, I got to come up with something.
You know what? I think it goes back to what you said earlier, which is Jeffrey Epstein. And the argument is going to be,
that's the only one that counters that.
Well, not so fast. They're going to, what about, you know, the media mogul? So Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
So,
but that was a Me Too thing. That wasn't.
But isn't all of this 120 people suing you at once? Isn't that not a form of Me Too?
I'm not saying I'd be successful at it, but
there's somebody saying Me Too when you start off with 3,800 of them and you whittle it down to 120. Somebody said, "Oh yeah, and that was Me Too." I say that to say I actually think, as you said, that might seem controversial, but you know there may be some truth to it. The flip side, though, is that I think what you have at perhaps its core, and Judge, we may learn this as we delve into more episodes in this case, but I think what we have maybe at its core is we have an entire entertainment industry. And no matter what point you enter this industry, whether it is through music, whether it is through art, whether it is through television or the big screen or some other entry point, but there is something inherently insidious about the industry itself that I believe has known about the behavior of all of these individuals. I mean, consider R. Kelly, who is the R&B.
Casting couch.
yeah. I mean, or what about Adelson? You know, who's out at Fox? Or what about Bill O'Reilly? Or what about Matt Lauer? Or, I mean, you can go on and on and on. I mean, even, you know, you know, beloved Chris Matthews. A lot of these individuals either are gone or have left under the under either direct allegations or the cloud of suspicion related to allegations of sexual misconduct in the industry in general. And by the way, it's the same industry that has consistently kept this behavior under wraps, has allowed individuals to be and remain unaccountable, except for perhaps the most pervasive forms of it. Imagine if, you know, if we had followed the R. Kelly case, we would see some very distinct parallels to Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, and the allegations against Mr. Combs, as well as, again, if there had been, you know, perhaps an effort to do so. And I'm not suggesting I substitute my judgment for that of SDNY or any other prosecutor's office, but it very well could have been Mr. Trump had he not been the prior president of the United States. It is entirely
We're almost out of time, but I'm dying to ask you one more question. So if we can try to keep this succinct, I really think it'd benefit our listeners. In a case like this, where there are allegedly other big name celebrities, music people, people that we all would know immediately, involved in these freak-offs. In the normal case, you would find charges against them first, get them to plead to something fairly minor, and then go after the kingpin. In this situation, it seems reversed. Does that bother you at all?
Absolutely not. You know, I don't know that I care so much in what order the responsible parties are made responsible. As a former prosecutor, the method of going after, if you call it the little fish, in order to ultimately get to the big fish was because it made it easier to build the case against the big fish. However, if you have a case where the big fish,
you don't need it.
You don't need it. It's just, this is extra. But you already essentially built the case against the big fish because, you know, information or evidence is just there. It's obvious and it's clear and it clearly points to these crimes. Then yes, what you can do is you indict the big fish first, and then as your investigation continues, then yeah, you know what? It's like the madam with the black book, right? And you never want that thing published because, you know, you only
we're gonna have a lot to talk about on this case.
Boy, are we? And the more names you learn, you're develops. Just gonna your brow is probably gonna furrow every time you turn on a movie and you say, "Wait a minute, I think I heard that name involved in the P. Penny case," because he's not gonna be P. Diddy anymore. He's right. Gonna have pennies, but it's gonna be. I mean, you even have Gloria Allred that I think is representing one of the victims in a separate civil case, and that's going to again. This is all gonna be telling, but I think it's to your point, which is the other individuals that will no doubt perhaps become a part of this, either as co-defendants or cooperating witnesses, because they may be able to escape prosecution if they
cooperate. A lot of immunity given out on this one, I bet.
Man, if you don't know it, and I'm sure you heard it as a defense attorney, as a prosecutor, I used to say the first to squeal gets the deal. And so there are probably a whole lot of folks whose attorneys are burning up the prosecutor's phone line saying, my client wants to come in and just talk. Or we'll just come in and just listen and see what you have, and we'll determine from there what we'll do. But yes, they're
because
probably
otherwise you're going to get a lot of Fifth Amendment. I can't testify against myself, so you're going to have to give something out as a prosecutor. But it's going to be really interesting to follow. So I want to let our audience know that we'll be on top of this as we go through, and coming on October 9th. They're supposed to set a trial date.
Yes, we're going to be looking for speedy trial. So October 9th, speedy trial is it. And we'll tell you all about it in the next episode. So keep following us.
Maybe not the next episode, but the next episode about Diddy. You
indeed,
know, so,
the next Diddy episode.
the next Diddy episode. We want to thank all of you for listening to Next Witness, Please. And Judge Gale always does a tremendous job of telling people how they can find us.
And so we invite you to come and follow us, listen, and please like us, subscribe, check us out, and keep coming back. You can find us anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. We want to first give a shout out to one of our biggest supporters, and that is NPR, National Public Radio. You can find us there. You can find us on Apple, on Spotify, and again, anywhere else you would find your favorite podcast, just look for Next Witness, Please. We will be happy and honored that you've decided to join us, because we always say you don't trust what you don't understand, and our goal is to help you understand this process better.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can always email that to me at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, Hodson at ohio.edu. And if you have topics you'd like for us to cover in the future, and some people have already done this and we've got them on our list, please shoot us an email. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law on another legal matter. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
And take care, folks.